The Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office gets big ethics rebukes, Miami-Dade's migrant workers get some historical recognition, and Broward County gets a lot of cricket. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine charges of rogue prosecutors under Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle. Will a new appointment restore public trust? This is Immigrant Heritage Month, so we'll look at a new study underway to profile the rich and indispensable legacy of South Florida's migrant farm workers. And with the Cricket World Cup coming to Broward next week, including a match featuring the U.S. team, we'll ask, how do you play this game? All that coming up right after the news. Tim Padgett, welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Last month, Jose Arrojo, who'd been head of the Miami-Dade County Commission on Ethics and Public Trust, announced he'd be resigning that post. He'll be coming to work instead for Miami-Dade County State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle. We don't know for sure, but he'll presumably head up an ethics oversight unit in her office. And according to defense attorneys and other watchdogs, her office sorely needs it. Fernandez Rundle has been Miami-Dade's top prosecutor for 3 decades. But in recent years, she's come under criticism for the allegedly rogue misconduct of some prosecutors, especially Michael Von Zandt, who for 10 years directed the controversial use of a convicted murderer to gather information about criminal suspects inside a jail. Von Zandt resigned this year, but organizations like the Miami chapter of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, as well as many legal experts in the state, say the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office needs significant reform and review. Does the controversy at this critically important South Florida institution concern you as well? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Brittany Wallman. She's investigative journalist at our news partner, the Miami Herald. Also with us is Lauren Field Krasnoff, president of the Miami chapter of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Brittany, thank you for having us.
Brittany, I want to start with you because I'd like you to walk us through what you and your Herald colleague, Sarah Blasky, reported this week about perhaps the most egregious ethical issue facing the state attorney's office, that questionable deal that prosecutor Michael Von Zandt oversaw starting a decade ago, using a convicted murderer, William Little Bill Brown, to ferret out information about suspects inside a jail. What lines did Von Zandt allegedly cross, and how did it end up compromising cases?
Well, what we found was that, unbeknownst to everyone in the public, this murderer had confessed to prosecutors to killing 3 people, including 2 teenagers, in one of the biggest shootings at the time.
Right.
And prosecutors made a deal with this guy. They gave him a real sweetheart deal for killing. I mean, he's killed probably 5 people or been involved in 5 killings.
Right.
He gets 25 years, and then they've got their guy in the jail. So instead of being shipped off to state prison, they keep him in the Miami-Dade jails for the past 10 years and have used him to collect intel on cases that he had nothing to do with, and in ways that, you know, it crossed ethical boundaries as well as legal and constitutional, according to the folks that we talked to.
Right. Now, tell us a little bit more about what our judges and legal experts saying now about this, especially what do they say made this more troubling than other instances of using criminal informants to help build cases, which I think, you know, on TV,
you know,
detective crime shows we see all the time.
Right, right. You're like, okay, he's a snitch. I understand what that is. And
right.
Yes, there. I mean, many cases are built with jailhouse informants and snitches and flippers, cooperating witnesses. Well, he did flip on, usually an informant is someone who decides to flip on the people they committed a crime with.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that. He is that guy. But where you go wrong, according to everyone that we spoke to, including prosecutors, everyone agrees it's improper to use someone to go out and collect information as sort of, you could think of him as sort of a deputized agent of law enforcement who's mm-hmm. secretly approaching people who have lawyers. They have right to remain silent. They have, so they're mm-hmm. sharing information with him, and he may be asking questions because he wants to please the prosecutors. He's hoping to get a reduced sentence.
Right,
and,
because he could have been facing the death penalty.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right. I mean, probably five times over.
Yeah.
And so, in addition, his plea deal requires him to cooperate. And if he's found to have violated the plea deal, he's getting a life sentence. That's in there.
Right.
And you can tell, we listen to some jailhouse audio where he's frequently calling a Miami police detective as well as prosecutors. You can just hear in the tone of voice the eagerness to please. Hey, how you doing? You know, yes, I can look into that. I can check into that. And the prosecutor said, you know, we did not ask him to ask questions, you know, so they're denying that. But when you create somebody so beholden to the prosecutors, I mean, it is in his interest to go out and ask questions when they say, hey, we want to know X, Y,
right.
Z.
But the underhanded nature of it is really that, you know, you could also be violating the rights, as you pointed out, of these criminal suspects.
That's right.
As it were.
It's not cool.
Now, Lauren Field Krasnoff, I know you've presented State Attorney Fernandez Rundle with other examples of prosecutorial misconduct that you and the Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys argue are evidence that the Von Zampf case is not isolated, that there is something systemically awry inside the state attorney's office. Can you tell us about some of those other examples you've identified?
Absolutely. I think what is reported on in the Miami Herald recently is actually not the first instance of misconduct that was reported by the Herald and other news outlets in the last couple of months. In March, Judge Andrea Wolfson issued an order disqualifying Michael Von Zampft and another prosecutor, Stephen Mitchell, from a separate case involving similar types of misconduct. And in that order, although she doesn't go so far to disqualify the entirety of the state attorney's office, she identifies that Stephen Mitchell defending Michael Von Zampf's conduct is indicative of a culture that is toxic to this idea of justice. And so following that order, my organization actually had already been investigating specific prosecutors after we identified patterns of misconduct amongst those prosecutors. But following that order from Judge Wolfson, we requested this meeting with the state attorney, and we brought with us examples. And I was very specific and told the state attorney that these were mere examples. We received a lot more information from the defense bar about incidents of misconduct, but these were things like state attorneys listening in on conversations that they with defendants who were represented and not identifying themselves on the phone calls. Mm-hmm. These were incidents where prosecutors spoke directly to reporters about things that should never have been released to the press, including disparaging defense lawyers and accusing them of committing crimes.
Mm-hmm.
This went so far as executing search warrants on defense experts and defense attorneys and misrepresenting to the state attorney herself what was known at the time that those warrants were executed.
Right. Now, I should point out that Von Zandt, Mitchell, and other prosecutors involved in this controversy insist or deny any wrongdoing, just for the record. But I wanted to ask you also, what was the state attorney's response when you presented her with these complaints, particularly your request that she set up an ethics oversight unit in her office? She said when you met with her last month that she wanted 45 days to consider the proposal. What's going to come of that, would you say?
Sure. So I will say I don't think that any of the issues that we brought to her attention were brought to her attention for the first time. I think that every single instance of misconduct was something that had been filed in a court pleading and therefore had been brought to supervisors, had been brought to the attention of senior staff at the state attorney's office, if not the state attorney herself, and nothing was done. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is when we are trusting that office to police themselves and they're not doing it, it yeah. means that they're condoning this type of misconduct.
Now, Brittany, I'm sorry, I want to move here to Brittany. What has been the state attorney's response to your own reporting in the Miami Herald about these problems?
Well, good question. We have not heard from their office. We had an editorial this morning and that she had told the editorial board that she was, you know, concerned or would look into. But what we haven't seen is any, you know, real we're going to launch an investigation into this or anything mm-hmm. like that. You know, the Florida bar is looking at the prosecutors, and I think we'll certainly be following that. But it remains to be seen.
Lauren Krasnoff, what do you and the Miami chapter of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, and I should point out to our listeners that your members are the lawyers who come up against the prosecutors from the state attorney's office in criminal cases, so you're not an impartial player in this dispute, but what do you think has been the cause or causes of the alleged prosecutorial misconduct that's so much in the spotlight now?
I think, unfortunately, there's a culture of winning at all costs, and that is trickling down from lead prosecutors like Michael Von Zampt and other people that I think are giving bad advice to the state attorney. You know, I saw a quote in Brittany's article from one of the chiefs in the office, Steve Talpin, saying that when they make mistakes, they correct them. And that is just absolutely not the culture from the top down at that office. Mm-hmm. They double down, they defend themselves in court, and they do not give up even when they see that misconduct has been committed by the people in their own ranks.
Brittany, what's your take as someone who is a more impartial observer here? What seems to be the root of these problems?
What I see is, definitely a permissive culture has built up over years. And I think, you know, to be honest, people necessarily didn't listen to defense attorneys when they've complained about it over the years because, mm-hmm. you know, it's in their interest to get this out there. But it was really when the judiciary stepped in, when that judge stepped in and mm-hmm. called BS on the prosecutors, that really caused people to take it seriously.
Just quickly, is it perhaps a case of complacency resulting from the fact that Fernandez Rundel, who is 74 years old, has occupied the state attorney post for so long?
I think you can't deny that she has built connections and trust and definitely, her office has been given the benefit of the doubt.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Brittany Wallman of the Miami Herald and Lauren Field Krasnoff of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys about the serious ethics controversy at the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So we've been talking here about the problem that many see inside the state attorney's office. I'd like to pivot now to the possible solution. It would seem that State Attorney Fernandez Rundel is amenable to setting up some sort of ethics and integrity oversight in her office because the gentleman I mentioned at the outset, Jose Arrojo, who had been heading Miami-Dade's Commission on Ethics and Public Trust, will now be joining the state attorney's office. Lauren Field Krasnoff, was this the step you were looking for or not?
No, it wasn't. Saying absolutely nothing about Jose Arrojo, who has an excellent reputation. Like I said, the state attorney's office has proven that they cannot police themselves. This misconduct happened while Mr. Arrojo was at the office and continued after he was there. What we've asked the state attorney to do is to establish a unit right. that is headed by a person or a committee of people who have never worked for her before and don't work for her now.
Right. You want more independence in this post then, yeah.
Absolutely. We want a conviction integrity unit that examines whether or not ethics rules were followed in prior convictions. And we also want a case integrity unit so that current prosecutors can go to somebody that is not at the office at this time and review ethical issues with them and a place where defense lawyers can go to say, hey, this issue is arising. Can you please take a look at it? You have an inexperienced prosecutor who may be doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Because right now, our complaints are just not being heard, and they're going without consequences. And the result of that is the state attorney is condoning the behavior.
But
so someone needs to come in from the outside.
Right. But Brittany, let's say this is the direction Fernandez Rundle wants to go in. Will Arrojo be effective in terms of, you know, when he starts working for Fernandez Rundle, let's say, how will he function in what we assume, again, assume will be his role as an ethics oversight chief there for the state attorney's office? How will that work?
Well, as you say, assume, because we haven't heard any details about why he's being rehired or what he'll be doing there. But I think what is problematic in terms of reform is to bring somebody in who, you know, whatever his reputation was, who already has connections. He was a prosecutor. He may have biases. I mean, it's certainly not an independent party. So I'm not sure what kind of reforms that could lead to. And we know that, you know, everything in government is slow, especially change. And so I don't know if we can anticipate, you know, some major seismic shift.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you both before we end here. Let me start with you, Lauren Field-Krasnoff. What have we seen in other jurisdictions, whether it be Florida or in the rest of the country? What have other jurisdictions done when they faced controversies like this that you know, you feel Miami-Dade should be doing?
Sure. So there are four, I think the Florida legislature recognizes four conviction integrity units at state attorney's offices that have been developed in the wake of accusations of misconduct or really just trying to do the right thing. It's usually happened when a new state attorney takes over.
Right. But you're talking about Florida. Only four counties, only four state attorney's offices in Florida do that?
That are recognized by the legislature.
Okay.
So Fernandez Rundle would say that she has, I think she calls it a justice something, but it's not recognized as an actual conviction integrity unit with the goal of examining whether convictions were obtained according to ethical procedures. So she doesn't have anybody right now that's looking into, for example, the Taji Pearson case to determine whether the type of misconduct that was identified by the defense attorneys is the sort of misconduct that should require independent review and independent determinations to see what they should do with the case. The people she has on that case right now, it's the same lawyer that was disqualified by Judge Wolfson on the other case.
Okay. And
so what needs to be done is independent people need to come in.
And Brittany, as an investigative journalist, what would you say is the norm that should be followed in terms of remedying a situation like this?
Well, to me, you know, they say sunshine is the best disinfectant. So I think having the press and everyone else, judges looking at this, could be the best thing that could happen.
All right. Brittany Wallman is an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald. Lauren Field-Krasnoff heads the Miami chapter of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
It's no secret that Florida's vital agricultural industry would probably collapse if not for the thousands of migrant farm workers who toil in the state's fruit and vegetable fields. That's especially true in South Florida, where migrant agricultural labor is a mainstay of places like Redland and South Miami-Dade. Most are from Mexico and Central America, and they do the indispensable work that most American citizens will no longer do. They're not just green bean and strawberry pickers. They're people, good, hardworking people who want to make it better for their kids just like the rest of us. And they have stories. Stories about the homes they left behind, stories about the lives they've lived here, stories about the communities they've helped build here, like Redland. Which is why Miami-Dade County's Historic Preservation Board just launched a 2-year study to profile local migrant farm workers and the history they've made. Since June is National Immigrant Heritage Month, we wanted to look deeper into that. What do you think about migrant farm labor here getting its overdue historical due? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN afternoon news producer Sherilyn Cabrera, who co-wrote our report on this study along with intern Elise Catrion Gregg. Sherry, how are you? It's great to have you on.
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
I want to start by playing a quote in your report from Sarah Cody. She's Miami-Dade County's Historic Preservation Chief. And here's what she had to say about what's behind this new study.
When we talk about the early formation, the early settlement and development of Miami-Dade, of its farmlands, we talk a lot about Henry Flagler and his railroad. We talk a lot about the homesteaders who bought property in the early 1900s and about the farm owners, who we often refer to as the pioneers of Dade. But very rarely do those stories ever include the many, many people who work every day to operate those farms and make them successful.
So, Sherry, listening to Sarah Cody there, I was sort of reminded of the example of the Black Bahamian settlers of the 19th century who played a big role in building early Miami, but never really got proper historical recognition for it until a century or more later. Is there that sort of feeling now about South Florida migrant workers, that their contribution to not just harvesting Miami-Dade County's food, but building the community here has been too long overlooked?
Yes, exactly. When talking to Sarah, she made it a point to stress just how important the migrant farm worker community was to Miami-Dade's development. And you just mentioned Black Bahamian settlers of the 19th century. When speaking to Sarah, she mentioned how the early formation of the county started with agricultural development that followed the railroad as it extended further and further south.
So there's always a Henry Flagler connection there somewhere, right?
Yeah. And so we know that agriculture and the people who worked and continue to work on these agricultural fields and who are mostly immigrants are deeply rooted in the county's history, but it hasn't been recognized on the same level that other parts of Miami-Dade County history has been recognized. Mm-hmm. Just like Sarah mentions in that clip that we just played. And so the Historic Preservation Board is hoping to change that.
Now, what sort of historical legacy will this study that Cody and the Miami-Dade Historic Preservation Agency be focusing on when it comes to the migrant farm worker community here? What sort of stories and accomplishments will it be looking at?
So really, the study's main focus will be to find places and locations that are historically significant to the migrant farm worker community. Mm-hmm. Because one of the requirements of the study is that by the end of it, they'll nominate at least one site to the National Register of Historic Places.
Right, and we're going to talk about that a little later. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the reason that this is sort of the main focus is because the study is focused, is being funded by a federal grant that's administered by the National Park Service. But while looking for these places, or by giving it the recognition it deserves, they'll be able to bring to the spotlight the people that have lived and walked and worked in these places. Mm-hmm. And this can range from activists who've done work throughout the decades to protect these farm workers and bring about fair labor practices. And the county says it'll rely heavily on the community. So they want to hear directly from Miami-Dade County residents. They want to hear their stories and experiences.
Right.
So, for example, maybe you come from a family that has had roots in the county's farm worker community for generations. So they want to hear those stories and those experiences.
Right.
And the county also says that they'll be partnering with various migrant farm worker organizations. So like the Farm Workers Association of Florida,
right.
There's the Coalition of Florida Farm Worker Organizations. Mm-hmm. And that's just to name a few. So even Sarah said that this won't be easy. Again, this is a community that has been mm-hmm. excluded in the overall conversation about Miami-Dade and its history. So
yeah.
Because of that, it won't be so easy to access.
Well, and I'm assuming they'll be wanting to look for the, as it were, the Cesar Chavez's of Florida. And which brings me to my next question. Florida is second only to California, again, the home of the great agricultural labor leader, Cesar Chavez. Only second to Florida in terms of agricultural production. And like Florida, California depends heavily on migrant farm workers to make that work. Do we know if California has pursued any sort of similar historical profile of them that Florida could, that use as a template, for example. And again, I would think of that legacy of agricultural labor leaders out there, like Cesar Chavez, would have driven that sort of thing there.
Right. So I haven't done deep research on this, but I can say from the little reading I've done that, yes, California has done historical work about their migrant farm worker communities. So, for example, in Santa Cruz County in California, which is located in the central coast area of California, in one of its local libraries, they actually have a center called the California Agricultural Workers History Center. Okay. And in that center, they conduct research, but they also have a collection of historical photographs, films, and mm-hmm. other papers that date back to the late 1800s. And they also collect stories from community members as part of a digital storytelling project. Yeah.
So there is a template there, yes,
right,
that we can build on here. Now, your report points out something sort of remarkable. Miami-Dade's population is 70% Latina, and yet only 1% of the country's designated historical sites, the county's designated historical sites are associated with Latino or Hispanic heritage. I mean, as a journalist, did that make you do a double take? I mean, I would have thought that the county's Cuban heritage alone would have filled up the sites by now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't totally surprised that it was a low percentage, honestly, but 1% was shocking to hear. And, you know, when thinking about designated historical sites associated with Latino or Hispanic heritage, you just mentioned, like, the Cuban population. I immediately thought about the Freedom Tower in downtown Miami, right by Bayside. As you know, like, that national listing, because it is listed nationally, it's a great example about a site that is deeply rooted in that heritage because of its role in the 60s and 70s with mm-hmm. Cuban refugees who sought political asylum. But there's not a lot of sites in Miami-Dade like that. But still, something interesting that the County Historic Preservation Board told me was that a lot of designated sites that have been listed for architectural significance mm-hmm. usually have a broader history that has right. been excluded from previous
architecture tends to be the right. marquee thing there. But you said nationally. Now, right. it's not just a Miami-Dade problem. You report only 8% of the roughly 95,000 historical sites on the National Register are associated with racial and ethnic minorities or women. Is there a big push going on now to rectify that both in Miami-Dade and across the country?
Yes, absolutely. Part of what has prompted Miami-Dade County's Historic Preservation Board to take on this two-year study is the fact that the board has started to take on a more critical eye on where they've fallen short mm-hmm. on their preservation work. So when I talked to the county's Historic Preservation Chief, Sarah Cody, she explained that while looking back at the preservation work that's been done in the last couple of decades, they realized that the county's, like we mentioned, you know, that it doesn't adequately reflect the diversity of Miami-Dade County. And that's also something that the National Historic Preservation Board realized, too, in the last couple right. of years. So this two-year study in Miami-Dade, I mentioned that it's being funded by a federal grant. Mm-hmm. That grant is called the Underrepresented Communities Grant.
Okay.
And it was mm-hmm. created specifically to increase representation mm-hmm. of diverse groups.
When we think of South Florida and Miami-Dade's history of migrant farm workers, we may not have a marquee figure like that Cesar Chavez figure I pointed to earlier. But your report identifies pioneering migrant labor organizations like the Centro Campesino or Farm Worker Center in the 1960s. What was important, for example, about that movement?
Yes, so Centro Campesino actually used to be called Organized Migrants in Community Action, or OMICA. They eventually changed their name to Centro Campesino, but that organization formed in Homestead in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. And historically, Centro Campesino has advocated for fair labor practices and fair living conditions for migrant farm workers, as well as fair medical treatment and access to this treatment in South Dade. Mm-hmm. So Centro Campesino still operates out of Homestead today.
Right.
But that's just one organization, right? There's many more who are based out of South Dade.
Sure.
There's also the Coalition of Florida Farm Worker mm-hmm. Organizations that has had a long time presence in South Miami-Dade
and,
as well.
And groups like We Count, right. et cetera. Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Sherilyn Cabrera about a new study underway to profile the history of Miami-Dade's vital migrant farm workers. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Sherry, we were just discussing some of the groundbreaking migrant farm worker movements here in South Florida in the last century, but what are some of the big changes this new, what are some of the big challenges this new study will likely look at in this century? You cite things as basic as housing, but I would imagine Florida's recent anti-immigrant legislation, for example, is a big concern as well, no?
Yes, I would say this is a big concern for the actual migrant farm worker community. But as for the study itself, there aren't really any specifics on what exactly it will look into and what will be done with the results, aside from the designating sites for their historical significance.
But I would imagine that this study, since it's going to make the migrant farm worker profile higher and give that community more recognition, I would imagine that one of the results they're hoping is that it will also help to improve conditions for these migrant farm workers,
yes.
No?
Yes, that's the hope, at least. I actually had an email exchange this week with the executive director of Centro Campesino. His name is John Martinez, and he basically said that he really does look forward to the process and the outcomes of this study. But he added that if the focus is only on finding buildings and spaces for historic preservation, then this two-year conversation may not be of much value. And how I interpreted that from John is that I think migrant farm workers and these organizations that work closely with them, I think they're looking for more urgent solutions and more action.
But let's go back for a second to the historical aspects of this study. You mentioned, and this is what we were mentioning earlier, you mentioned that the county's historical preservation folks have already identified a place down in Florida City, for example, that they could nominate as a focus of the history of migrant farm workers here?
Yes. So Sarah told me that as part of the application process to get the underrepresented communities grant, they basically had to nominate a potential site. So this property is down in Florida City, and it's this oolitic limestone structure that's historically been known as the Coachella House.
Uh-huh.
And it has served as the offices of the Coalition of Florida Farm Workers Organizations for about 30 years. And the Coachella House is actually already a Miami-Dade County designated historic site, but they want to get it listed nationally.
Uh-huh.
But this is just one site. Their ultimate goal is to identify more than one.
Okay. So in the end, what is going to be, you know, we mentioned that this is going to be a two-year study. So when it's finished in, say, 2026, what will be done with the results?
So that's something that is still, like, we still don't know what will be done with the results.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But finally, Sherry, in the minute or so we have left, I also wanted to ask you something else very important that occurs to me about this. And the feeling out there that this study could address something else about Miami-Dade's Latino profile. The Latino conversation here for so long has been so dominated by the Cuban, Venezuelan, Colombian, Puerto Rican communities, groups that really aren't part of the migrant farm worker equation here, the way Mexicans and Central Americans are. You mentioned to me that your father, for example, is from Guatemala, so you're part of that very important Central American heritage here that is so often overlooked in Miami-Dade County. Could this study help rectify that?
I think so, or at least I hope so. My family, they aren't associated with migrant farm worker communities,
right.
But they didn't settle in South Dade. They're more from the northwest area of the county, but I think they're very much a part of Miami-Dade's history. I know plenty of Guatemalans, Hondurans, Salvadorans. I grew up knowing them my whole life, and I'm 30 now. So I could just imagine what this looks like in South Dade, and I hope this is just the beginning of that recognition because we're a big demographic.
Mm-hmm.
We exist, and we're part of the county's history.
True. Sherilyn Cabrera is WLRN's afternoon news producer. Sherry, many thanks.
Thank you for having me.
The only thing most of us know about cricket is we don't know anything. Maybe you've heard it's baseball's British ancestor, the way rugby is football's predecessor. Guys play cricket every weekend in Coral Reef Park near my house. I love to walk over and watch, and I have no idea what they're doing. But I and everybody else in South Florida should get real familiar with cricket real quick, because next week the Cricket World Cup, which is being played in the U.S. for the first time ever, is coming to Broward County. Four matches, in fact, will be played at the Broward County Stadium in Lauderhill, including one featuring the U.S. team, which stunned powerhouse Pakistan yesterday. But that's not the only reason we should learn about the sport. Cricket has a big South Florida connection because it's a hugely popular sport in the Caribbean, thanks to its British colonial history. Aside from Team USA, you can expect to hear many fans here, from Jamaicans to Guyanese, rooting for the West Indies team, known as the Windies. Are you a cricket fan? Do you want to know more about the sport? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. In the studio now, we are very fortunate to have WLRN intern reporter Carlton Gillespie, who does know a lot about cricket and is set to educate us. Carlton, how are you?
I'm great, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So, Carlton, let's start first with the big news, right? Team USA upsetting top-ranked Pakistan yesterday in Texas by 5 runs. Next week, the U.S. comes here to play Ireland. Now, you wrote for WLRN recently that the U.S. wasn't expected to be a contender in this World Cup. Have they changed your mind?
Well, they haven't changed my mind, but I think it's important to note that this is a monumentous upset.
Yeah.
The USA isn't supposed to be here. They're only here because they're hosting.
They're hosting it, right.
And to take out a team like Pakistan that is consistently one of the top five cricketing nations in the world is a dream start.
Yeah. And it would be like the U.S. beating Spain in soccer in the World Cup, right?
Something close to that. Yeah. Or maybe Japan beating Germany in the last World Cup, earth-shaking.
Yeah.
But it may not change their contender status, but it certainly changed the dynamic of that Ireland game.
Uh-huh.
Because now that becomes a big circle. If they can beat Ireland and pull off another big upset, they have a chance of making it into the final eight.
Getting out of the group stage and into the knockout round, yeah. Well, whether Team USA is a contender or not, I think a lot of folks here who would first like to know better what it is Team USA is doing out there so they can know what they're rooting for.
Yeah.
So, Carlton, I want you to walk us through the basics of cricket. It looks like baseball, but it's not baseball. First, how many players does each team field, and what are the positions we see them playing out in the field? The guy who pitches the ball, for example, is not called a pitcher, right?
Right. Those are called bowlers.
Right.
And there's not just one guy. So each bowler will get an over, which is 6 pitches, mm-hmm. and then they'll rotate out.
Okay.
Now, you see those guys with the big dramatic run-ups and then fire it up. Those are pace bowlers who bowl the ball quickly, and the guys with shorter run-ups with a ton of spin are spin bowlers.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned baseball, and the cricketing fans listening are going to hate this, but imagine baseball in 360 degrees.
Okay.
So there's the bowler, there's the wicket keeper, or kind of like the catcher, and then everybody else is kind of playing a free shift. So depending
now,
on if the...
The wicket. That's very important here. So the catcher is protecting the wicket.
The batter is actually protecting the wicket. But
okay.
Think of the wicket are those little wooden stumps that are behind the batter in front of the wicket keeper.
Yeah.
And if a bowler hits those without a batter hitting it, you're out.
Okay.
So think of that as like an automatic out strike zone there.
That's like 3 strikes
exactly.
in one pitch.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So we've got the bowler, the catcher. What are the other players out on the field doing?
They can move from pitch to pitch, but it's normally set up by either the bowler or the wicketkeeper or a defensive captain who's saying, you know, hey, this guy likes to pull the ball to his right side.
All right.
We can move more guys to the right side to kind of counter that. Or he likes to play the ball behind him. We'll make sure we have a defender back there. So it can move from batter to batter, from bowler to bowler. Those are kind of free positions.
But still, their job is like an outfielder. They've got to be out there to catch the ball if the batsman, and again, he's not a batter, he's a batsman.
That's right. Right?
If the batsman hits it out there, and their job is to catch it.
Exactly. Yeah. And outs are so important. They call it taking a wicket is so important in cricket because mm-hmm. once you're out, you're out. So imagine a baseball team, you know, Mike Trout comes up in the first inning. If you strike him out or you catch his fly ball, you don't have to deal with Mike Trout anymore for the rest of the game.
Okay. Now, on the offensive side of things, what we call batters in baseball are called batsmen in cricket. And just as important, again, what role does that wicket play in terms of, you know, advancing the game, scoring the game, et cetera? Why is that so important?
So it's what the batter is out there to defend. The defense's okay. whole job is to try and hit that wicket, either with a pitch or to hit the wicket on the opposite side once the batter puts the ball in play.
Okay.
So a batter will put a ball in play and run across.
Meaning he hits it.
That's right. And it's important to know there's always two batsmen on the field at every time, which is a thing that can be kind of confusing to American audiences. So say a bowler is bowling from left to right, yeah. and the batsman on the left side puts it in play and they run across one time. That's one run. Now the other batter has a chance to hit the next ball.
But when I watch the guys in the park play, they're running, you know, after they hit the ball, they're running to another wicket, it looks like.
That's right.
Okay.
So because on every over, the bowler will switch sides of where they're bowling to.
Ah, okay. All right. Okay. So take us through a cricket match. What is each side trying to do and what's the format? I mean, cricket does use the term innings, for yep. example, but does it mean the same thing as innings means in baseball?
It is. It's very close. So I mentioned two batters on the field at the same time. You've got mm-hmm. two teams of 11, which means you've got 11 batters out there. Basically, if you can get 10 wickets, they can no longer keep two batters on the field because there's only one guy left. So the team is done batting. That's one way to end it. Or you can run out of overs. You know, this is a limited overs format. I think, you know, we may talk about that a little bit later, but it's very similar. Once you're out of batters, the top half of the inning is done. The other team comes up and hits. Try and score more runs. It couldn't be simpler.
There you go. Now we have Peter from Little Havana on the line. He's a big cricket fan. Peter, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
We're talking about the upcoming match between the United States and Ireland, as well as all the other matches that are going to be happening. The Lauderhill Oval is spectacular. It's one of the few places in South Florida where you're actually able to watch cricket of high caliber.
Right.
Every year the West Indies does a T20, which is basically a shortened version yep. of cricket, and they always host their fifth match out of a five-match series. The other four are throughout the Caribbean, Trinidad, Jamaica, whatever. But the fifth one's always here.
So Peter, are you going to any of the matches next week?
Yes. I was listening yesterday to United States shocking the world and taking right. out Pakistan. So uh-huh. I went online and I found tickets, believe it or not, $14. Now, they're terrible seats, but you can work your magic in Miami. So
all right.
I'm sure we'll have a shade.
Well, Peter, have a great time. Now, he mentioned T20. Now, you pointed out to me, Carlton, that the format of cricket being used in this World Cup is T20. What does that mean exactly?
So there are two types of cricket. There's test cricket and limited overs cricket. Test cricket is what Americans think of, you know, five-day, three-day matches that take forever.
Forever, yeah.
Limited overs is just that. So a T20 is a 20-over match. So each team will see 120 pitches.
Okay.
What that means is in test cricket, your job is don't get out. And in T20, your job is score more runs. It's a shorter version of the game, and it's much more exciting. There's much
because,
more
because
offense.
Because it brings more offense, which is what especially American audiences
and
love
it's
to
shorter.
See. Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN news intern and cricket aficionado Carlton Gillespie about the Cricket World Cup that's coming here to Broward County next week. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Carlson, just really quickly, I'm curious, how did you, an American lad, get involved with cricket?
Well, my partner used to work in the city of Lauderhill and would always tell me that cricket was a big deal out there.
Ah, okay.
And we had a friend who was playing for Team India in one of their the citywide tournaments. We went out to watch one match, and I was immediately hooked. The atmosphere, the party atmosphere, the game itself is a ton of fun. Meeting everybody is super friendly. So from then on, I've been hooked.
Yeah, and as I mentioned at the outset, cricket does have quite a substantial following here in South Florida, thanks to our deep ties to the Caribbean and South Asia, where the British Empire left its footprint. Tell us about the surprisingly well-established cricket culture, not just here, but around the U.S.
Well, for now, cricket exists in small pockets. I think here is definitely the largest one in South Florida, but in Orlando, there's a great contingent of cricketers. You know, the vice captain of the U.S. team now, is from Charlotte, North Carolina, where there's a growing community of cricket players. And then obviously the big immigrant hubs in San Francisco, in New York, and those places have always had a good cricket following.
Right. Now, there are also cultural differences within the sport, too, right? I mean, the Brits, not surprisingly, have a more formal, stuffier style of play, while teams like the West Indies or the Windies, which obviously has a fervent following in the Caribbean community here, bring a more party feel to the game?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, in England, you'd get maybe, you know, a nice meal and a bottle of Moscato to watch the cricket. And, you know, at the big stand in Kingston, you know, it would be more of a party atmosphere. Yeah. I spoke to Chris Deering, who is the lead executive of the 2007 Cricket World Cup, and he told me a story that in 1995, they invited this little-known rapper from Brooklyn to come down and do a set at the stand, and he thought, oh, who's this guy? We'll give him a Thursday, no big deal. Yeah. And that was Shaggy, and that was when he debuted Mr. Bombastic. So hey, it's much more of a party atmosphere there.
That's great. I want to play a nice quote here from one of the South Florida cricket enthusiasts you interviewed for a recent mini-documentary you did. This is Zach Sutter of Tamarack, who learned the sport as a kid from his Guyanese father.
Oh, man, it gives me butterflies. Just seeing the players like that of that caliber. It's memories that last a lifetime, right? And for that to be coming to the States and for the next generation to see their favorite players coming and playing in the U.S., I mean, it brings so much joy to me, so much happiness that we're getting that type of recognition.
Okay, that type of recognition. So, Carlton, you've pointed out that cricket already has a decent following in this country, but should we expect this World Cup to broaden the sport's appeal, especially since Team USA just put the tournament on the news wires this week by upsetting Pakistan?
Well, I think we just saw that principle in action with our caller earlier. He saw the match yesterday and bought a ticket, and I think that's the goal, is to grow cricket organically in the United States. There's already, you know, the South Asian and the Caribbean folks that live here are going to watch cricket no matter where they are, right. And it's about expanding that culture and expanding that atmosphere, you know, out.
Now, what position, for example, do you play when you play the game?
They haven't let me get up there yet. But, I used to play volleyball, so I think I'd be a pretty good bowler with the overhand delivery.
Okay. Now, finally, how will next week's four games, especially the U.S.-Ireland match, which, as you said, becomes much more important now, how is that going to put Lauderhill and Broward County on the map as a cricket mecca?
Well, really, they don't need to be put on the map for the larger cricketing community. They've already hosted, as our caller mentioned, the West Indies play there. West Indies and India have had bilateral matches. Ireland and the United States have played there. They are already the first ICC-sanctioned cricket stadium in North America. Their place in worldwide cricket is set. But it's about, you know, the people of Broward who aren't in the cricket community to know that an international stage is happening right in their backyard. So hopefully large enough crowds, big enough atmosphere, and thankfully we've adopted more of a party atmosphere from the Caribbean than a more stuffy atmosphere from the Brits.
Right.
But I think it can really attract people, and it's a great time out.
Who do you think those fans in Broward County are rooting for more, Team USA or the Windies?
It's West Indies and India. There's a massive, you know, South Asian population, and the India fans will never support anyone other than India, and the same goes for the West Indians.
Which brings me to my final question then. We've been talking so excitedly about Team USA's upset of Pakistan yesterday, but who are really the more realistic favorites in the World Cup? You just mentioned India. I would imagine they're up top of the list.
Yeah, India and Australia played last year in a 50-over World Cup final in India, and Australia won. And you shouldn't be surprised if it's India and Australia once again here in the T20
Australia.
Final.
Australia. Now, that's a country we hadn't mentioned before, but it makes sense. Again, a former British colony.
Yep.
Right.
I mean, think of it this way. If you ever had the British in your country and you tried to get them out and it didn't work right away, you're probably pretty good at cricket.
WLRN intern reporter Carlton Gillespie is a cricket aficionado. Carlton, many thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Finally on the roundup, former Miami Heat All-Star Alonzo Mourning is known for his philanthropy across South Florida. His new mission is to raise awareness about prostate cancer. The 54-year-old Mourning was diagnosed with stage 3 prostate cancer earlier this year. He's now cancer-free after undergoing surgery to remove his prostate in March. He wants men everywhere to know it's not taboo to talk about your health, especially prostate health. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men other than skin cancer. 1 in 8 men will get it in their lifetime. I personally count several friends among them. Here's what Mourning had to say at a press conference earlier this week.
Today, right now, I'm cancer-free by the grace of God. It's a lot of people that won't be as lucky as I am. But I feel like if I can reach them before it gets to that point and they're able to make the right health decisions for themselves, then that's what this is all about.
Mourning encourages men to ask for prostate-specific antigen tests, or PSAs, which are not always done during routine checkups and physicals. Please get checked. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Acevedo and Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives engineered today's program. Anita Lee took calls. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.